Thank you very much. This year is the Le'ilui Nishmas Mecha Bas Menachem Manas and Chinka Bas Alexander Mordechai. May the Neshamas have an Aliyah. And good morning, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving, or whatever you say in America. I will not be strictly following the outline. That's the bad news. The good news is most of this will not be on the final. So, first of all, when we talk about Ta'amei HaMitzvahs, so the verse in Tehillim says, Ta'amu Ura'u Ki Tov Hashem. Interesting pasuk. It means taste and see that Hashem is good. This sounds like an Osem advertisement. You know, taste and see that it's good. What does it mean, taste and see that Hashem is good? How do we understand that verse? I think what it's saying is, Ta'amu, meaning look at the meanings behind the mitzvahs. Taste the mitzvahs. Rav Eliyahu Dessler, in a conversation with my Rebbe, Rav Moshe Shapiro. So Rav Moshe asked him, he was a teenager, he asked him, I don't get it. All these Rishonim and many, many of the great Jewish scholars spent a lot of time trying to figure out reasons behind the mitzvahs. So as a teenager, he asked Rav Dessler, how do they do this? I don't even know the reason my best friend does something. How could we possibly understand why Hashem would decree something? There's, as the great medieval poet said, Ilu yadativ hayitiv. If I'd know him, I'd be him. So how can we possibly fathom the mind of Hashem? And Rav Dessler responded, he said in Yiddish, I'll translate, he says, Tamei mitzvahs, there is the geschmackkeit from the mitzvahs. Meaning, Tamei mitzvahs, literally he understood, not as a reason, but as the taste, the effect, the geschmackkeit of a mitzvah. In other words, why Hashem ultimately decreed something, ordained something, may not be something that we can know. That's trying to understand the motivations of Hashem, as the Rambam says in Moreh HaNevuchim, is futile. Assuming that what we understand is the reason that Hashem said something, again, seems futile. But to understand the effect of a mitzvah, to see its impact on the person, to see his impact on society, on the environment, on the world, that's something that we as humans can certainly do. That's something which is very possible to do. So I'd like to discuss a few aspects of this idea of Tamei HaMitzvahs. What I want to do, first of all, why do we need to know Tamei HaMitzvahs? The Rambam tells us, as you can see in the outline, I mean, first of all, the Mishnah, although the Mishnah seems to imply that one should not look into the reasons for the mitzvahs, the Mishnah says, Ha'omer al kan sipor yagir rachamecha, a person who prays and says, as Hashem, as your mercy reached the mother bird in the bird's nest, who you commanded us to shoo her away before taking the bird, the eggs, etc., so your mercy should also reach us. And the Mishnah says, Meshaskin oislo, we silence a person who says that. Why is that so? That seems to imply, as the Gemara says, two things. The Gemara has two reasons for this. Number one, it says, because in a sense the person is making divisions amongst the beings in creation. You're saying God's mercy is on the bird, but not on the eggs. God's mercy is on the bird, but not on the cow. Mercy is on the bird, not on the goat. That sounds strange. And the second reason given in the Gemara is that you make Hashem's mitzvah into an act of mercy where it's a decree. Now that sounds like, Einam Eila Gezeirois, they are only decrees. That sounds very much like the Mishnah is saying that there are no reasons for the mitzvahs. And the Rambam, in Moreh HaNevuchim, Guide for the Perplexed, actually understands the Mishnah that way, but he says, we don't paskin like that. That's not how we rule. We rule in accordance with the view that says there are reasons for the mitzvahs. And that Mishnah does not go according to that halacha. That is how the Rambam understands it. Nachmanides, the Ramban, understands it a little differently. He says, no, we agree with that Mishnah. It's just that we don't believe that the purpose of the mitzvah is for the benefit of the bird. It's for the benefit of the human being who shoos away the bird. When Hashem gives us this mitzvah, it's so that we should not be cruel, not so that the bird should be okay. We will see a little later that there are ramifications to how you understand this, the reason for this mitzvah. But basically, the Rambam goes on to say, if you look in Mishnah Torah, Hilchos Tmura, and he says the following: even though Kol Chukei HaTorah Gzeiros Haim, even though all the statutes of the Torah are decrees, K'moshe Bi'ano, as I explained, Ra'ui Lizbonen Bahen, one should look into them, investigate them. Kol Mashata Yacholi Tein Lotam, Tein Lotam, as much as you can give reason, rationale for it, you should do so. The Rambam is telling us that it's actually a job of the human being to look into the mitzvahs of the Torah, even those that we classify as chukim, and try and figure out a why behind that. And he doesn't explain clearly why that's important, but he explains in another place why that's important. In Shmoina Prakim, the Rambam poses a contradiction. On the one hand, he says, Rav Shimon ben Elazar, he quotes as saying, who says, Al yomar odom ef shili babasa chazir, a person should not say, I can't stand pork. Sausage makes me nauseous. Cheeseburgers are disgusting. He should not say that. What should he say? I would love some ham. I would love a cheeseburger. Rather, Hashem said not to. Now, that sounds as if, ideally, you should crave that which is not allowed, and you should overcome your desire, and that is the superior. And indeed, he says, the Gemara says that a tzaddik, a righteous person, is someone who does overcome their desires. But he says, on the other hand, philosophers say that the higher level of the person is someone who does not crave evil. Someone who does good because they desire to do good. As it says in Mishlei, Nefesh Rosha Ivsora, the soul of the evil person desires evil. So how do we reconcile those two opinions? On the one hand, the Chazal tell us that you should say, I would love the cheeseburger. You walk by the hot dog stand in the city, which I saw one that said, halal meat parv. So he's trying to market to Jews, but obviously his PR firm is not very good. So anyway, you look at this and you say, I would love one of those hot dogs. Is that okay? According to Chazal, that is actually okay. And it sounds like that is the best thing to do. It says you should not say, oh, disgusting. You should say, I'd love that. So the Rambam distinguishes, this is in the sixth chapter of his introduction to Pirkei Avos, the Rambam distinguishes between two types of mitzvahs. Some mitzvahs, he says, most of them, we understand the reason. For instance, it's interesting, Chazal don't say that a person should walk around saying, I would love to murder, steal and pillage. But Hashem said not to. He does not say that. The example used in this statement is an example of a mitzvah which is not immediately understandable. Meat and milk. Pork. That's not immediately obvious to us. That's more along the lines of a chok. And therefore that's, the Torah says, there it's designed to instill in me a sense of obedience and humility towards Hashem. But certain mitzvahs, most mitzvahs, we understand the reasons for them. And therefore we're supposed to incorporate them into our personality. And so the higher level of person is someone who abhors violence, who finds theft disgusting. Not someone who craves it but overcomes. If you crave theft, violence, etc., but overcome it, that's good. That's good. I'm not encouraging you to do it. To overcome that is actually good. But it's not as good as someone who doesn't desire it at all. So in certain mitzvahs, we would look at them as being lessons in obedience, maybe a chok, but in the majority of mitzvahs, they're not so much lessons in obedience as lessons in morality, ethics. They are intended to instill in us a certain ideal, a certain ethic, and a certain moral. And that's really one of the reasons we're looking into the Tamei Mitzvahs. I want to know what is an effect of this mitzvah, what is it supposed to instill within me? And that's something which is of great value. So that would be one purpose in studying the reasons for the mitzvahs. Another purpose, and this is actually implied, the Gemara says, there's a story told in, actually it's in the Medrash really, not in the Gemara, Turnus Rufus, who's a Roman, used to often debate the rabbis, so he comes over to Rabbi Akiva, And he says, "Hey, Rabbi Akiva." Actually, I don't know if the ancient Romans had Italian accents, but whatever. He says, "Hey, Rabbi Akiva, what's better, the deeds of God or the deeds of man?" Now, his intention here, as Beisalevi explains, was to attack Judaism. Because he was saying, if you tell me the deeds of God are superior to those of man, I will then counterattack by asking how you have the chutzpah to change anything in this world. If you tell me the deeds of man are superior, he will then counterattack by saying, you must be a heretic, because how could man be better than God? So Turnus Rufus figures he's got Rabbi Akiva. He's got him. It's an arm bar. He's going to have to tap out. There is nothing he can do about this. So Rabbi Akiva does not immediately answer. Goes to the fridge. And he comes back with a stalk of wheat and a three-layer chocolate mousse cake, Sacher Torte, the moist chocolate cake with Sacher Bakery Vienna with the hint of raspberry, chocolate mousse, white chocolate mousse, dark chocolate mousse. Anyway, so he comes over and he says, Rabbi Akiva says to Turnus Rufus, which is better? Deeds of God weighs around the stalk of wheat. Deeds of man weighs around the chocolate mousse cake. What was Rabbi Akiva teaching us? Very simple. He was teaching us that God did not create a perfect world. God created a world that's designed to be perfected. He did not create a perfect human, with some obvious exceptions, but where he created a human with the desire or the need to be perfected. And the mitzvahs are the means to attain that perfection. Mitzvahs elokat surufa, lo nitnu ha-mitzvahs el letzaref behen ha-sabrias. The mitzvahs are given to refine humanity. Letzaref has two meanings. This means to join, letzaref, and it means to refine, to remove impurities. Those appear to be two opposites, you know, right? Letzaref means to, like kesef tsaruf, shivatayim, refine silver, that's you remove impurities from it. But it also means letzaref, to join together. But it means both things. As the Derech Hashem, Moshe Chaim Lozato explains in Derech Hashem, very clearly he says, the mitzvahs are designed two things. Mitzvahs asay, oh, thank you very much. Mitzvahs asay are designed to instill within us certain positive, but to join us to positive concepts, to positive morals, positive ethics, etc. Mitzvahs lois asay are designed to refine us, to remove impurities. So when it says that the mitzvahs were given letzaref has both meanings: to A, refine and remove impurities, and B, to join to positive ideas. And that really is what Rabbi Akiva was teaching us. Hashem could have created a perfect world. He did not do so. He created a world that we need to perfect, and we do that through the acts of the mitzvahs. And the Rambam furthermore says in Hilchos Me'ilah, and you'll see also Hilchos Mikvois, primarily Hilchos Me'ilah here, which I've quoted, which he says that we should be careful about the reasons we give. They should not be idle guesses. They should not be, in a sense, what he says, profane. But he says it should be understood that there is wisdom behind the Torah. And he actually offers another reason that we would try to understand the reasons, which is to show the wisdom of the Torah and to show the truth of the Torah. If the Torah, and as it says, the Pasuk says, that it's supposed to be our wisdom in the eyes of the nations. If I cannot explain why I'm doing this, if there is no reasoning behind it, there's no logic behind it, I just say, it's just what I do, then that detracts from the general wisdom of the Torah and the Kiddush Hashem involved, the sanctification of Hashem's name involved in explaining and understanding the Torah. I think there's also another reason for understanding the reasons, which is motivation, or in Hebrew, motivatsia, which is that when you understand something and why it works, if a physician may tell you a procedure and explains how the procedure works, or a medication and explains maybe what the mechanism by which it works is, or even especially in psychology, explains why it works, then it may be more effective. And I may be more motivated to do it if I understand it. And so that's certainly an example of it when it says, Tamuru ki tov Hashem, taste and see. Even if I'm doing the mitzvah not for the ideal reason, I should still do it. As the Gemara says, La'olam, yasak adam b'Torah mitzvahs, engage in Torah mitzvahs, even shelo lishma, because eventually you'll understand it and you'll do it for its own sake. But I think that's at least a few of the ideas behind Tamei HaMitzvahs. And the Brisker Rav once said, in commenting on that Rambam that I quoted before in his introduction to Pirkei Avos, he says, one of the ideas behind mitzvahs being given with reasons that we can figure out is so that we can inculcate and absorb those reasons in our lives, in our personalities. I want to give you a couple of reasons for the mitzvahs, which I think are fairly original and at least struck me as being very interesting and fit into these ideas. Like, for example, tumah, impurity. So we know that certain things impart tumah. For example, the greatest form of tumah is a dead human body. Tumah. It imparts tumah, if it's Jewish, by just being under the same roof, by touching it, by touching a metal implement that killed someone, a sword, for example. So that's maximum level of tumah. And there's many different levels of tumah impurity. There's tumah shratzim. Certain types of animals, dead animals, convey certain tumah. There is tumah due to various types of emissions, venereal diseases, etc. There's a whole range of tumah. What's the idea behind it? So I want to give you three thoughts about this. Very, very different. The Rambam, in Guide for the Perplexed, he says the purpose of tumah is, this is, I just found this amazing, he says, is in order to prevent you from going into the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, anytime you feel like. He says the purpose of going to the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, is to be inspired, to contemplate Hashem, to come close to Hashem. If a person would be able to go anytime they wanted into the Beis HaMikdash without thinking about it, in the original Judeo-Arabic, every muntig and donashtig, if he goes into the Beis HaMikdash without thought, it will not have the impact on him. Your person goes in, so with the laws of tumah, what they do is they create within us a mindset that any time I go to the Beis HaMikdash, what do I have to do beforehand? I have to think. I have to prepare myself. I have to say, whoa, do I have to go to the mikveh? Do I have to wait until evening? Do I have to have something sprinkled on me from the Parah Adumah? In other words, tumah is designed to create an awareness of my entry into the Beis HaMikdash. It is designed to create preparation for entering so that whenever I come into the Beis HaMikdash, it's not just a happenstance. It's not just, oh, I've got a few minutes spare. No, I have to think about it. I have to prepare for it. And I have to do some action to get me ready. That's amazing. What that means is he's understanding tumah not necessarily as an expression of some deeper spiritual reality in the human being, but he's understanding it as preparatory for entry into the Beis HaMikdash, preparatory for prayer, preparatory for contemplation of Hashem. It's a very, very fascinating understanding of tumah, quite different from the way most of us may have understood it. It's the Rambam's view. Very similar is Samson Raphael Hirsch, who says that tumah, and he goes through a lot of the halachas of tumah, and he understands it. He says, not as, I love the words in the English translation, not as a noxious effluvium, but rather, he says, as something which affects the way you think. He says, because what happens is, we believe, you don't have it in the outline, he says, what we believe that the human being is soul and body, that the spiritual and moral ultimately is in control of the physical and can be in control of the physical, that your moral free will can control your physical desires, and that moral free will can control what happens in this world. He says, what is the greatest illusion, the greatest contradiction to that belief? What will be the greatest contradiction to the belief that morality, that the soul, that free will controls the physical? You know what the greatest contradiction to that is? Death. Because death shows the physical overcoming the spiritual. A dead body, you don't see the soul, you don't see the free will. What happened to all that glory, that greatness of the free will? What happened to the greatness of the soul? Gone. So the illusion that death creates is the illusion that the physical is greater in power than the spiritual. And he says that illusion is what we call tumah. What's the lowest level of tumah? The lowest level of tumah that we know. Rabbinic tumah, which we get every night, we go to sleep. Sleep creates a low level of tumah. We wake up in the morning, wash our hands. Why? So, you know, the Talmud says that sleep is 1/60th of death. I had a roommate that it was 2/3. But, So he, you know, in the morning he needed para aduma, I think. Right, but anyway, but for most of us it's 1/60th of death. What's the idea? Because when you're asleep, what's in control? Free will. Free will is not in control when you're asleep. When you're asleep, it's the physical that's in control. So therefore, it's a low level of tumor. And he says he understands one of the most puzzling types of tumor, impurity, which refers to discusses childbirth. What could be more beautiful than and life-giving childbirth? And yet, the mother becomes tamei afterwards. He understands this as because here also, the woman who gives birth is being controlled by forces, physical forces, far greater than her free will. I had a student seminary, very young. She was probably 17, and she was already thinking about getting engaged. I did not think that was a good idea. She was very immature. She asked me, this is an actual question that she asked me. She says, is it mutter to give birth on Shabbos? I said, seriously? That's what you're asking me? Right? You have no choice in the matter. There's not a choice. It's not like, oh, shall I decide to give birth now? No. Right? Birth is something where the woman is controlled by forces far greater than herself. And that creates the illusion that the physical controls the spiritual. And therefore, Rav Hirsch says, that's where tuma comes from. It's the mind is harboring the illusion that the physical controls the spiritual. Any time we have that, tumah. So we have the Rambam who understands tumah as a preparation for entry into the Beis Hamikdash. So it should not just be without thinking. Always have to think, am I tahor, am I tameh? What do I have to do before I go to the Beis Hamikdash? Rav Hirsch, who understands it very, very differently, he understands it as the illusion in the human mind that the physical controls the spiritual. And that illusion is dangerous, because Judaism is predicated upon the idea that free will controls the physical and can control that, and our moral free will is the highest level of power in this world. And then you have others, like for example Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who understands tuma as type of, I hate to use the term, but ontological reality, that within the soul there is some type of pagam, there is some type of flaw as a result of contact with these things, and that's manifested in the halachas of tumah. So those are three ideas behind tumah. To give you another example, I found to be fascinating, is basar v'chalav. So we mentioned meat and milk, right? When the leftover turkey after tonight, you cannot have turkey and Swiss on rye. That is prohibited, rabbanon, but it's still prohibited. Okay, so one of the ideas behind meat and milk is, you know, if you look at the posuk is strange. What does the posuk say? Lo tevashel gedi b'chalev himo. Right, it says, Reishis b'kurei admascha tavi beis Hashem alokecha. The first fruits of your land bring to the house of God. Lo tevashel gedi b'chalev himo. Don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. You look at that posuk. So what has the first part got to do with the second part? Bring the first fruits of your land to the Beis Hamikdash, to the temple. Don't have a cheeseburger. Make sure, bring bikurim. Don't eat that. Right? No. What's one got to do with the other? So a lot of them are forced and discuss this, but one of the most fascinating explanations I saw was the Ralbag. The Ralbag says the following. He says, what is the foundation of the mitzvah of bikurim, first fruits? Gratitude. Express it in Yonah de Yoma. Expressing gratitude to Hashem for the benevolence and the goodness he's given to us. So he gave me fruit in my field, my orchard. I take that fruit, the first fruit, which I'm most excited about, most happy about, most proud of, and what do I do with it? I give it to Hashem. Take it to the Beis Hamikdash. Ultimately, gratitude is taking the goodness that Hashem gives us and using it to bring us closer to Hashem. Reishis b'kurei admascha tavi beis Hashem lekecha. So the Ralbag says, what is meat and milk? He says, when you think about it, milk is the chesed, the kindness that the mother bestows upon its child, her child. The mother gives to the child and sustains the child. It's, as I think as Shakespeare, the milk of human kindness. Okay? That is what milk is. He says, cooking the kid in the mother's milk, could you imagine anything more in denial of that goodness than taking that goodness and life-sustaining goodness of the mother and using it to cook the child in? Could there be anything serious, like from the perspective of the mother, what could be possibly worse? You're taking the outpouring goodness, he says, so the Ralbag says this, everything that we have, our life, our existence, everything we have is the milk of Hashem's kindness that he's bestowed upon us. The ultimate lack of gratitude, the ultimate lack of appreciation is taking the goodness that Hashem gave to us and using it to cook ourselves, so to speak. Using it to rebel against Hashem, using it to hurt ourselves. If I use the goodness that Hashem gave me for something negative, for something that hurts me, that hurts humanity, that hurts the soul, what am I doing? He says, I'm cooking the kid in the mother's milk. I'm the kid. Hashem is the mother. The milk is all the brachas, that everything that Hashem has given to us and continues to give to us. So the Ralbag says, what meat and milk is about gratitude. It's about don't reject the goodness of Hashem by taking that milk of his goodness and cooking yourself in it and using it to rebel and using it to hurt yourself. Am I making sense here? So the Ralbag says, take the first fruits of your land dedicated to Hashem. Reishis b'kuri ad mascha, tavi beis Hashem. That's the first part of the pasuk. Take the first fruits and the goodness that Hashem gives you, dedicated to Hashem. Don't take the milk of the mother and use it to hurt the child. Us. He says every time we do a sin, it's bosa v'cholov. Because every time we do a sin, we're doing it with the goodness that Hashem gave us, our life, our existence, our limbs, our intelligence, our money, whatever it is. And what are we doing with that? We're cooking Hashem's child in that, i.e. us. So the Ralbag sees it as an understanding. Not eating meat and milk together is an amazing reminder of the concept of gratitude to Hashem, because I have to think of milk, outpouring of chesed. Cooking the meat, that's the ultimate denial of that chesed, the ultimate insult, so to speak, to the milk of the mother. That's how he understands Bosor the Cholov, which I found to be just fascinating. I mean, other commentaries say that it is Achzarius Belev, that it's a similar idea, but they don't explain it as well, I think, as the Ralbag. Others say that to be able to take milk, which symbolizes it is the outpouring of goodness and of life of the mother to the child, and to be able to eat that with a dead animal shows a certain callousness towards where things came from. The idea of remembering that this animal that I'm eating, the flesh that I'm eating, is a dead animal. Milk requires life. So mixing them together is a certain degree, we're forgetting where it comes from. So they say to appreciate where it comes from, but that's slightly different from the Ralbag. Another example of a fascinating explanation of myths. I was standing at a bank in Australia like 2 summers ago, and it was not in Melbourne, where there's a fair amount of Jews. It was not in Sydney. It was in some area. It was near the Great Barrier Reef. I'm standing there, and I feel a tug on my tzitzis. And I look behind me. There is a elderly woman who is holding my tzitzis, looking at them. I said, "Madam, that is attached." Right. She said, "Oh, I'm sorry." She said, "What are they?" I said, "They're fringes that Jewish men are supposed to wear on four-cornered garments." And she said, "Wow. Interesting. It looks like there's something unfinished in your garment." And I said, "Madam, it's exactly the idea." The Meshech Chochma, Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, in his commentary on the Torah, he says the idea behind tzitzis is that we have to understand the world as being unfinished. Humans are unfinished. And therefore, as a reminder that we are supposed to finish the job, we are supposed to weave the rest of the tapestry, we're supposed to finish the picture, fill in the dots, etc., we have a part of our garment, the corners of the garment, is unfinished threads. They're not woven yet. They're not tied. They're not embroidered, no macrame, etc. They're just threads. So he says that tzitzis, how is tzitzis a reminder of all the mitzvahs? Forget the gematria. Gematria is very nice, but how many people are conscious enough when they put on tzitzis to actually remember the gematria? Right? I mean, a lot of people, the first conscious thought we have in the morning is when we get to Hayom Yom. Right? First, time we actually think of that. Right? But again, one of the ideas of tzitzis is to remind us of this concept that the world is indeed an unfinished place. I'll give you just, two more, but Egla Arufa. So there's a city where they find a murder victim, dead body, and you determine which city it's from based on probability. You determine by how close it is, population of the city, geography, many factors the Gemara discusses. You determine, and we figure probably he came from that city. The elders of the city and the whole town goes out to a riverbed outside the city, slaughters a calf, and the Sanhedrin, the court, says, Yadeinu lo shafcha sedam, our hands did not spill this blood, please atone for us, God, etc. It's a strange type of mitzvah. It's unusual. But the Rambam, his explanation in Moreh HaNevuchim is, I think, amazing. He says the following. He says, we have an unsolved crime here. How is the Sanhedrin going to figure out who did this? He says, when everyone in the city is out in the one place and everyone's talking about this crime, he says, agents of the Sanhedrin will be circulating amongst the crowd, listening to the hearsay, to the gossip, maybe being able to find witnesses, being able to find evidence. It's like, the police going around canvassing the crowd, canvassing the block, find out what happened, did anyone see this, etc. So he says, it's actually a pragmatic, the Ramban, Nachmanides does not like this, as you might imagine, right? But the Rambam understands it as being a very pragmatic way of helping to solve the crime. That maybe, if the whole city's out there and everyone's talking about this, and it's such an unusual event, maybe the agents, the shlichim of the Sanhedrin, will pick up some idea and they'll be able to hopefully bring the criminal to justice. And I want to give you one more example before I get on to the last part of the class, which is, and I should point out, all these fit in very beautifully with the Rambam. If you look in Moreh HaNevuchim, which I've quoted here, it's very long, I'm not going to be death by outline to read it. But the Rambam points out that he says, when the Jews came out of Egypt, Hashem says, I'm not going to take them through the land of the Philistines because they'll see war and they'll become all, oh, it's terrible, etc. They'll become demoralized, they want to return to Egypt, so I'm going to take them in a roundabout way. So the Rambam says, why couldn't Hashem have just, he did the miracles of the crossing of the Red Sea, he did the Makos, the 10 plagues, why couldn't he have just said, okay, I'm going to turn the Jews into SEAL Team 613, right, and they'll all be battle-hardened commandos, right, Sayeret Matkal, whatever it is, right, etc., and they'll be able to confront the Philistines. So the Rambam says, because Hashem doesn't mess with our minds. We have a principle that Hashem will do a miracle. He will cross the, he'll split the Red Sea, yes, he'll bring plagues, but he will not mess with your mind. He wants you to develop in a natural way. He says, for the Jews who've been slaves for hundreds of years to confront a warlike tribe like the Philistines immediately after coming out of Egypt, that is not human nature, cannot do that. But through the tribulations of living in the desert, through the tests of living in the desert, the Jews will become tougher people. The Jews will become better at confronting adversity. They'll become soldiers. They'll have courage. And he says the gradual development is what Hashem wants. He says this is the basis behind all of the mitzvahs. The mitzvahs are designed to... Hashem could have created us perfect, but he didn't. He created us imperfect because he wants us to develop it through our own devices, through our own efforts, through our own free will, and do it in a gradual way rather than Hashem just creating it that way. Because if Hashem, and here the Rambam doesn't say this, but Ramchal does say this in Derech Hashem, in, I think, second chapter, he says, because if Hashem would create us that way, we would not be righteous. If Hashem makes me a tzaddik, I am not a tzaddik. If I make myself into a tzaddik, then I'm a tzaddik. If Hashem creates a person as a rosha, he's not a rosha. If that person chooses to be a rosha, to do evil, then he's indeed a rosha. Because the goodness and the opposite, in order for it to be really good, has to come from within you, and you have to be Baal, in the words of Lozato, Baal Hatov Hashleimo Tahi. You have to be the master of that completion, that perfection. If you didn't do it through your own free will, it's nothing, it's meaningless. And so he says, therefore, his explanation of the mitzvahs is always based on this idea that they are there to develop a great, noble, moral human being, as does Rav Hirsch. And of course, many, many of those who discuss the mitzvahs, Sefer Achinuch and others, also follow this general idea that it is the development of the human being through their own efforts, which is the basis of the mitzvahs. I'll mention one more, which is just a strange one, Schartner's. You know, Schartner's is always a bit of a puzzle to us, you know. Schartner's, which is, you're not allowed to wear a garment with wool and linen woven together or spun together in it. I mean, I could wear a linen, a linen tie, and I could wear a wool suit, but if they're woven together, no. So it's the weaving together in your clothing of wool and linen prohibited. It's a strange thing, and it's always defined as a chok. So Rav Hirsch explains it in the following way. Rav Hirsch says this. He says, what do we have in common with the animals as humans? Reproduction and consumption. Food. Right. What do animals have in common with vegetables? Same two things. Right. Plants reproduce and plants need nourishment. Animals reproduce, animals need nourishment. Humans reproduce, humans need nourishment. He says, now, the animal has advantages over the plant. What are the advantages? It has intelligence. It's very mobile, etc. What does the animal use those advantages for? What does the animal use its advantages over the plant for? Reproduction and nourishment. In other words, an animal is basically nothing more than an intelligent zucchini. Right? No offense to animal lovers here, but that's what the animal uses its advantages, its superiority over the plant to be a better plant, to reproduce better and get more nourishment. He says, now a human being has advantages and superiority over the animal. We have the soul, which is the expression of our dignity, or dignity is an expression of the soul. We have free will. We have much greater intelligence, etc., etc. He says, now, if a person uses their superiority over the animals and plants for nourishment and reproduction, what are they? A talking zucchini. He says, what is it that exhibits our superiority, our difference from us and the animals? Clothing. Clothing is an expression of human dignity. As the Gemara says, Rav kare lamane mechabdusei, Rav called his clothing mechabdusei, meaning that which expresses my dignity, my honor. He says, clothing, we don't want the Shana's linen, which comes from a plant, a flax plant, and wool, which comes from an animal. And in the Torah, any time we talk about beged, it's either wool or linen. It's not polyester, it's not cotton, it's wool or linen. He says so, but combining those two together is really saying what? That the superiority that I have over the animal and over the plant, they're intertwined. It's used only for the same two things as the plant, reproduction and nourishment. He says, when I separate those two, what I'm really saying in my garments is that my superiority over the animals and plants is to be used for higher purposes than mere survival. And that is why when I wear a garment which is not there for mere survival, if I'm a Kohen in the Beis HaMikdash, can I have wool and linen together? Yes. Why? Because there clearly the garment is not there for pragmatic purposes. It is being used for a higher purpose. Tzitzis, technically, can tzitzis have wool and linen together? Yes. because I'm not wearing tzitzis for survival. I'm wearing tzitzis for a higher purpose. So, but when a garment that I'm wearing, so to speak, for pragmatic purposes, for survival, there we have to be careful to remind ourselves that yes, I have superiority over the animal and superiority over the vegetable, but not to use that superiority for those things which I have in common, intertwined with the animal and the vegetative. It's a reverse understanding of sharpness. Now, I want to end with three examples of where Tamei HaMitzvahs actually affect the halacha. Normally, we don't think that that does, but there are cases where Tamei HaMitzvahs actually affect the halacha. So I'll give you one case, three cases, if we have time, hopefully. You're not allowed to bring an animal as a korban under 8 days. Pasuk shor chesev o'ez ki yivaled vaya shivas yamen tachasimoy. Right, you can only bring an animal as a korban from the 8th day onwards. Why is that so? So the reason, very simply, is that you're only allowed to bring an animal which is a full-term pregnancy. If it's called a nafel, meaning premature birth, you cannot bring it as a korban. We worry that it's treif, that it's not healthy, etc. So now, if you are not tracking your animal, how do you know if it's a full-term pregnancy? You don't. So what do you have to do? If you wait for the animal to be 8 days old, we can be certain that it is not, that it's healthy, it's a normal birth, and you can bring it as a korban. Okay? Now, halachically speaking, what if I know that it was a full-term pregnancy? We monitor our cows very carefully, right? And I know it's a full-term pregnancy. Can I bring a korban under 8 days? What would you say? The answer is no. Right? Because that reasoning that I gave is a reason. The halacha is the halacha. The Torah says, don't bring an animal as a korban under 8 days. Period. So even if I know that it's fully developed, even if I know that it's totally healthy, even if I know it's a complete full-term pregnancy, etc., doesn't matter. Can't bring it. However, the Rambam says, in the same way I cannot bring an animal as a korban under 8 days, I can also not eat it if it's under 8 days old. But when I'm eating it, it's a different story. If I know it's a full-term pregnancy, I am allowed to eat it even under 8 days old. So in the case of the korban, I cannot bring it if it's under 8 days, even if I know it's healthy. Whereas when it comes to the prohibition of eating it, if I know that it was a full-term pregnancy, I can eat the animal, shecht it and eat it, even if it's under 8 days old. What's the difference? So the Mishnah Melech says, very simple difference. He says, the only reason I'm not allowed to eat the animal under 8 days, Torah doesn't say that, I infer from the reason for the commandment that is prohibited. But since the whole prohibition only comes from the reason, then that same reason also is there to permit it if I know it was a full-term pregnancy. Is this clear? I'll give you another example. This is the last example. Halakhically speaking, maybe the second last. I know I have 5 minutes. Fine. Right. The halakhically speaking, it's a mitzvah. The last mitzvah in the Torah is you have to write a Torah scroll. Right? You have to write a Torah scroll. Most of us probably have not written a Torah scroll. We've maybe written a letter in a Torah scroll or whatever it is. But you have a mitzvah to write a Torah scroll. If you look in the Shulchan Aruch says nowadays, very strange, nowadays it's a mitzvah to write and acquire the books from which we learn. Chumash, Shas, Gateway to Judaism, etc. Right? These are the books we have to acquire. So that sounds like the mitzvah of writing a Torah scroll no longer applies. There's a famous machloikas hapoiskim, the Taz and the Shach on the spot in Shulchan Aruch. Some poiskim say that if you wrote a Torah scroll but did not have any sforim available from which we learn, you have not fulfilled the mitzvah. You spent $40,000, did not fulfill the mitzvah. You spent $29.99 on Amazon, you fulfilled the mitzvah. And some poskim say that what it means is if you only wrote a Torah scroll, you still have an obligation to buy sforim. So how that seems to be modifying. Now, why is that so? So Lubavitcher Rebbe writes in the Kutei Sichas, right, that the reason is simple. The Torah says, Ata, now, Kisvu lachem es ashira hazois, write yourself this song, the Torah, Limda es bnei Yisrael sima b'fiam, teach it to the Jews, place it in their mouths. So the Torah is explicit about why you're supposed to write a Sefer Torah. Why are you supposed to write a Torah? So you have available the Torah so you can talk about it, so it can be a testimony, so you can learn it. He says, does anyone learn from a Torah scroll? No one learns from a Torah scroll nowadays. You don't take out, let's learn, take out, let's take the Torah. No, you can't do that. People don't do that. What do you use? You use Sforin. That's what you're supposed to do. So here we have a mitzvah which is being modified by the fact that of the Tam. Now, the Rabbi Shrevi holds that all the Tam just adds a further obligation. It doesn't replace the original mitzvah, but it says even if you did write a Sefer Torah, you're supposed to anyway buy Sforim as well, because the Sforim are what you learn from, so you haven't really fulfilled the mitzvah in totality. Just one more example, literally a minute. This is very famous. If a bird has the misfortune of building its nest in a frum neighborhood, nebuch, what happens to it? There are hundreds of Jews lined up blocks around. There are buses, Monsi travel coming, etc. And this bird, the mother bird, is being shooed away hundreds of times because the Sefer HaChinuch says it's a skula to have children and other, etc., etc. So, Zachi Machloikas of the Chavos Yair and the Chacham Tzvi, if you don't need the egg, if you don't want the eggs, you don't need the eggs, you're not going to take the eggs, should you do this mitzvah anyway? So the Chavos Yair says, yes. Chacham Tzvi says no. The Chasam Sofer says the argument is very heavily based on the reason for the mitzvah. According to the Zohar, the reasoning behind this mitzvah is when the mother bird flies around crying for her children, that arouses the mercy of Hashem, the Shechina, for the Jews in exile, and consequently, it's a good thing to do. But according to the Rambam and the Ramban and most of the Rishonim, what's the reason for the mitzvah? Don't be cruel. Don't take both the mother and the eggs simultaneously. Let the mother live and then take the eggs. But if it's about cruelty, if you don't need the eggs, should you be shooing away the mother bird? Obviously not. So Chasam Sofer says, here it's a chumrah, which is a kula. Because I'm being machma on the mitzvah, but on the other hand, I'm going totally against the tam ha-mitzvah by being cruel to the mother. So that would be a machloikas aposkim, which the Chasam Sofer seems to understand. It depends on how you hold the purpose or the reason for the mitzvah. So we obviously didn't finish everything. Od chazon le-moed. Maybe we'll see you another time. And thank you very much for coming.